Good morning, everyone. My name is Maliki, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is Step by Step in Lafayette, Louisiana. And I do bring you greetings from my sponsor, Cajun Joe Orr, from Golden Meadow, Louisiana, who was with you in 1988. And I know when you very kindly, through Bill, invited me to come, I mentioned it to him, because I still do check with him. In fact, when I call, he asks me, is this a 911 call or is it a regular call? And I do want to thank Bill and Hank and the rest of the committee for inviting me, and especially to thank Bill, because he would call me regularly just to say hello. That is very different for me. Oftentimes when we're asked, then the next thing we hear is someone calls us to say we'll meet you at the airport or whatever, and Bill, I do appreciate you calling. I think that's the hand of AA reaching out to each other. Although I was kind of curious what Bill looked like and what he was, and when I finally met him and was around him a little while, I wondered how many were on the committee that sponsors him on a regular basis. Oh. Joe and Artie, thank you for being such gracious hosts. And also for the opportunity to meet Beth Friday night. I needed to hear what Beth had to say.
Powerful journey. Beth may not know anything about roosters, but she sure knows about God's grace. It was a gift to come across KC's path. I'd heard about him. And to walk with Francine W. again and to hear Tom B. in person. And Tom's tape is probably, you know, not all here because he isn't all there, huh? And now, my friends, for the rest of the story. I'm described in chapter 11, a vision for you. And I'd like to share a portion of that text with you. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. And as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. And then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror. Bewilderment. Frustration. Despair. And that was me, my friends. I don't deserve any of this. I do not deserve any of it. I never dreamed a time would come like this for me. But what Tom talked about last night, the self-loathing would go away. I was born and dragged up in Dublin, Ireland. That's my hometown. A came over here to the United States, to the city of New Orleans in 1971, 25 years ago. Sometimes I'm asked, how come you still have your accent? And I say, I saw no reason to change it. I was the second of four children, never wanted to be number two in anything. Still don't, my sponsor tells me. I don't remember too much about growing up. I'm envious of those who do. I was very happy. I suppose God gives me the people I need when I need them. Listening to Tom last night, talking about his journey with his parents. But mostly what I heard, which I keep needing to hear, is to be grateful for what was given to me. Because I'm an alcoholic and I always expect too much. There was alcoholism in our family. And all I know growing up, and this is not about other people, but all I knew growing up was that I never seemed to fit. Never seemed to connect, never seemed to be a part of anything. It seemed to me at times that I was safest within my own world. And I didn't trust anybody or anything. And I wouldn't let anybody in because that way you could not hurt me. And I didn't trust at all. We were raised Roman Catholic, as most people in the Republic of Ireland are. And became an altar server. But before that, I was introduced to the miracle of alcohol. When we as children had the runs or the trots, or diarrhea, I believe, as some people call it, my mother's solution for that was to fix a glass of hot milk and grate some nutmeg into it and put a shot of Irish whiskey or brandy into it. And what that did was it was supposed to bind up the stomach. And all I remember was the wonderful feeling just coursing through me. I just felt warm and I felt safe. And I felt wonderful. And I tried to have the trots as often as I could. Because I remember the cure. Then as an altar server, I was introduced to the state of California long before I visited it. In the squeezings of the grape, known as California wine. And every chance I got at the end of those cruets, if there was some left over, I would empty it. And when the sacristan wasn't watching, I would grab the bottle and take a few long swigs. And I felt good. And I felt safe. I used to get very mixed messages at home, though, about drinking. It was like if we didn't talk about it, it wasn't happening. When we'd see the local town drunk weaving his way up the sidewalk in the evenings, we as children, we'd call to our mom and we'd say, Mom, come see, come see. And we'd look out the window and she'd say, there's nothing like that in our family. I just remember odds and ends. And I'm trying to remember happier moments, and I know there were those. And I know today I can say to you that my father loved me. When he died at 18, he died a stranger to me. But I know he loved me in the way that he loved me. There was a roof over my head. There was food on the table and there were clothes on our backs. Maybe not what I wanted. But I do believe today he did what he did with what he did. My mom is my mom. Tom described his mother as a strict hard-shell Southern Baptist. My mother is delightfully traditional Irish Roman Catholic. And today I can say to you that I respect her beliefs because she was always consistent. I didn't like some of them worth a damn, but I respect them today. And Tom reaffirmed that for me last night, and Tom, I'm grateful. Because to me, we come to a meeting and we hear what we hear when we hear it. Rambled through high school, but it was always like, it always seemed, it was nuts. Like, it was like I was never happy within my own skin. I always wanted to be someone else. If only I could be like you, like you, or like you, or like you. And the messages I get at home, because I have an older brother, and he was allegedly the intelligent one in the family, and I was the one with the good looks. At least that's what I like to believe. And he was the straight-A student, and I forever heard you have to be like your brother, and I set out on a quest. I'd be damned if I was going to be like my brother. I was going to be as absolutely opposite and different to him as I could be. Later on in life, reading the story of the prodigal son, I wonder why I connected so much and used to cry copious tears. At the end of high school, I was wondering kind of what I would do, and I went off to college and went off to the seminary, and I was ordained a Roman Catholic priest in 1971. That's how I ended up in the city of New Orleans. Before I came across the water, I remember my mother exacting something from me, and she said, "Son, promise me that you will never drink and bring shame on this family." Mothers are very powerful. That created a lot of conflict for me, because I ended up in this church community on the edge of the French Quarter in New Orleans. For the first 3 months, I'd go out with a lot of different people, and we'd end up in some of the watering holes. And I was having Cokes, and they were having their Jack Daniels and their whiskey and their beer, and all just footloose and fancy free. And every time I was tempted to take a drink, I'd remember what my mother had asked me to promise. And for the first 3 months, I didn't. But whatever day it was, my friends, don't ask me. For I do know whatever evening it was that I lifted that first glass of scotch, I found all my answers. And those of us who understand, understand. And I became one of those that within a year I was a noon drinker, and within 2 years I was a morning drinker. I mean, I was off to the races. Things to extremes. There was nothing balanced. I love Tom again last. There was nothing balanced in my life at the time. And for some strange reason, my behavior came to the attention of the powers that be, those men in the pointy hats. And I was called in and asked to give an account of my stewardship. And what they chose to do was to move me. No one mentioned alcoholism in those days, although I was ending up in places that I might not normally end up in, associating with people that I might not normally associate with. Compromising my values left, right, and center. And they said, "We are moving you." And I said, "I'll fight you." Because I was city born and raised. And here I was in the city in New Orleans, and they told me they were banishing me to the swamps in South Louisiana. But God knew what he was doing. I lost. I was moved. And I went to this community in La Rose, Louisiana, with a massive chip on my shoulder. My sponsor told me since that when you've got a chip on your shoulder, it's definite proof that there's wood above. I had a chip on my shoulder, and I promised I was going to make life so miserable for those people in that rural community. What a lofty goal and motivation for a preacher, huh? Make life so miserable for those people who are going to scream and get me back to New Orleans where I belonged. It was very difficult to be anonymous in a rural community. And what they didn't know about me, they seemed to make up. But my drinking progressed, as it does for many of us, and I found myself on a daily basis going from different stores to different stores, and I kind of had my route on a daily basis. And I'd stop at Leday's on Monday and the IGA on Tuesday and Hubert's on Wednesday and Del Champ's on Thursday and Galliana's on Friday, and then Del Champ's took care of Saturday and Sunday. And after a while, it seemed to me kind of strange, because as I walked in the door of those stores, they were putting up the fifth on the counter. And part of me wanted to say, "This is wonderful service." And the other part of me was the horror of the alcoholic, which is they know. And I couldn't stand that, because I was afraid if I told you who I really was, you might not like me. 1974, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Two men came to visit with me, one of them who happens to be my sponsor today by God's grace. They did a 12-step in a kind of a roundabout way. I think they appealed to my monumental ego. They told me that there were people in the area that had a drinking problem, and I nodded very solemnly because they came visit me in the rectory. And they said they had meetings to help those people, and maybe I'd like to come to some of those meetings to see what they did. And then maybe come back to my church community and help those people who had a drinking problem. And I thought this was horrendously profound. And after they left, I fixed myself another drink because it seemed to me that I thought more clearly for some strange reason when I had a few in me. And I came to the conclusion I couldn't go because, my God, someone might see my automobile outside that place and someone might think I was one of those. And I didn't go. But my life kept going to hell in a handbasket. And I got to that stage again that Tom talked about that last night. Some people would call it low self-esteem. And he's so right when he calls it that, self-loathing. I literally hated everything I was and everything I had become. Because when I was younger, I had dreams. My first dream was I would never become like my father. And my second dream was that I was going to be riding a white charger, carrying a torch and changing the world. And here I was, that someone who made so many promises, I'll never drink again, I'll never use again, I'd pour everything I had down the commode, and a half an hour later be out the door looking for more. I hated me. I hated me. But I couldn't tell you that. From 1976 to 1979, I don't remember too much of anything. I just don't. It was like a constant blackout. I do know that from time to time I was drinking 2/5 a day just to live. And days had become nights and mornings had become evenings. And it just didn't seem to matter anymore. I do remember October 11th, 1979, vaguely. I got a call from, I call him a gentleman because he is, a gentleman. Bishop Boudreau, Cajun bishop, and I heard him say something to me that maybe others had said to me, but I'd never heard it in a long while. He said to me, "Maliki, I love you like a brother. Would you come talk to me?" And I went to visit him that evening in his home in Bayou Blue, and when I walked in the door, there were him and 11 other people there, all standing around the wall. And something told me that all was not well. You know, we alcoholics have a fascinating radar system. And I sat down with him, and of course, in my arrogance, I counted them. There were 12 of them and one of me, and I came to the conclusion that we were Jesus and the 12 apostles. And I don't have to tell you whom I thought Jesus was. He looked me in the eye and he said, "Maliki, I love you, you drink too much." For the first time in my life, I admitted to another human being I drank too much. Now, no one mentioned alcoholism. He said, "Will you accept help?" I said, "I sure will." He said, "Good, here's your airline ticket." And I thought I was moving a little bit too fast. Even though I found out later I was 260 pounds and I was dying on my feet and didn't know it. I started arguing with him. Meaningful discussion, you understand. And I told him, this was a Thursday, I told him I had a couple to marry on the Saturday, and then I'd go after that. He said, "Maliki, I think they love you more if you go tomorrow." I remember him saying that. So I decided, okay, hell, what, I'll go. Help sounded good to me. I didn't know what help meant. I didn't know what it meant, but I do know today that it was just my God walking with me, loving me. That's all I know. I went home that evening, I had a fifth of Bacardi in my drawer. I thought that couldn't go to waste. And then I called some of my friends, drinking friends, and told them I was leaving for a few days. And they said, "Well, come on up, we'll have a drink." They're shunting me off to a place in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm grateful to that place today. I call it a pause in my madness, where I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that night I was drinking with my friends, and in and out of the blackout, all I remember was us clinking glasses and They were toasting my success in treatment. And for a long time, I never understood what the word denial meant. But I had the disease of being different. Following day, I got on the plane in New Orleans. I flew to Chicago. I had four doubles. Between Chicago and Rochester, I didn't order any just to prove I didn't need it. I think I had a little problem with reality. They described my arrival at that place as two suitcases followed by a drunk. And they took a picture of me, and I still have that picture at home. I do not recognize the person in that picture. I was ravaged. And I had a horrible attitude. They tell me that after about 10 days, I began to come out of the fog. And there was this old guy, John was his name, from Los Angeles, that was assigned to me like a big brother. And he told me later on I was probably the most obnoxious, arrogant SOB it had ever been his privilege to meet. And I told him I appreciated the compliment. He told me I'd argue with him that I'd only be there a few days, and he'd say, "Oh no, Maliki, you'll be here a little longer than that." And I would say, "You're much older than I am. You need a lot more help than I do." Because I was the youngest person there. And I stayed there 3 months. I was a slow learner. I'm grateful to that place today because, despite my best efforts, they kept loving me. I sometimes hear from these podiums various opinions about treatment centers and psychiatric hospitals, etc. I do believe, my friends, this is my opinion, that God works where God works. That's my opinion. They brought us to meetings, my friends, shipped in the van, like cattle. I would not talk to anyone in that van. I would go to that meeting place downtown Rochester, about a third the size of this room. I would walk in the door. I would walk around the wall. I would not say hello to you. I would not let you shake my hand. I would not let you hug me. I would not let you touch me. I was one walking ball of rage. The first meeting I became aware of, and I saw this older gentleman sitting down at the end of the table, and he introduced himself as Art. Within 10 seconds, I canonized him as Art the Fart. I was not teachable at all. I was still the same old way, behavior and attitudes. I'll get you before you get me. January of 1986, 85, what was it? No, I'm losing track. Gray hairs. January 1980, my friends, I came back to La Rose, Louisiana. I was telling Tom and Beth and Rusty and Joe and a few more at the table this morning, Bly, that when I got back to that church community 3 months later, there was a big banner hanging in that church building. And it said, "This is the day the Lord has made. Welcome home, Father Mac." And I cried. And it wasn't tears of joy. It was still those tears of self-loathing, because I knew I was a phony. And here were these people loving me, and I couldn't let them love me. And they kept loving me. And soon afterwards, I moved elsewhere and pastored two communities and became a judge on the church tribunal and a diocesan official and all those things that happen to some of us that God seems to have a sense of humor with. And I went to meetings because I was told I had to go to meetings. But my attitude at meetings in my home group then, the South Lafourche group, Bayou Cajun group now, my attitude was, you'd read how it worked tonight. For the rest of the meeting, I believe I was called to tell you how it really worked. And my sponsor tells me that in those days, Maliki, many of us grew in love and tolerance. He said, "I believe God gives each group at least one like you, so that the rest of us can grow in love and tolerance. And I suppose I was the designated gift. So I stayed with that attitude, my friends, for the next few years, and everything seemed to go, I was still going to hell in a handbasket. Nothing had changed, but I was totally non-teachable. The first step read for me, I was willing to admit that sometimes I drank too much, and when I drank too much I got into trouble, but I was not willing to accept that I was powerless. I know today what insanity is, because that's what I was, insane. After 4 years of going to meetings, I stopped going to meetings because I decided I'd carried the message to you long enough. And now it was up to you to do something with it. I was very sick and very arrogant. And hated myself still, but I couldn't tell you that. And I stayed dry for the next year. And I was over the following summer visiting with my sister in Ireland. And for those of you who might be tempted to drink O'Doul's or something else like it, and because you'd say it's non-alcoholic, can I disagree with you? Less than 1% means more than 0%. But I know I had those O'Doul's, and I was looking for the effect, because we alcoholics drink for the effect. And all it did was turn me into a Russian racehorse, you know, and I just stayed peeing for the next 2 hours. A few days later, I didn't touch anything again, but a few days later, I'm sitting on the plane in Gatwick Airport in London on the way back, and the stewardess comes to me and she says, "Will you have something to drink?" And I said, "I'll have a double beef eater and tonic," and didn't even bat an eyelid. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. It waits. What that O'Doul's did to me was, I have a disease of thinking. I'm a legend in my own mind on a good day. I can look in the mirror and swoon. I heard one of these in my home group the other night. He's in and out the doors, bless his dear heart. But he has taught me not to look down my nose at another human being. And when he comes back, each time I listen carefully to him. He came back again this week. And he said, "You know what I think my problem is? My mind is on my mind." And I don't know if he knew what he was saying, but it said something to me about Maliki. My mind has been on my mind a long time. At 4 or 5 mixed drinks coming back across the Atlantic, felt wonderful. This was the summer of 84. And the light went off in my brain, which was, "You people put me through hell. You told me the first drink would get me drunk. And here I am after 4 or 5 mixed drinks, feeling totally in control. I'm not an alcoholic at all." And came home and did what I did, usually didn't drink, but I found myself out in Biloxi, Mississippi, on the Gulf Coast, at the Broadwater Beach, sitting in a dining room with the linen cloths and the soft music and the pretty waitresses, and she comes and says, "What will you have to drink?" And you know what happened. And after the third mixed drink, another light went off in my brain, which was, Maliki, instead of paying hotel prices for mixed drinks, it's much cheaper to go get a fifth and mix your own. And then the real horror began, my friends, because I was at that point that I hear others describing. I could not predict anymore what was going to happen once I took that first drink. That progression in our illness. I could take a shot and go into a blackout. I could drink a fifth and sit here eyeballing you. And friends who still loved me would say, Maliki, you're killing yourself. And I'd tell them where to go. And people in the church communities where I was pastoring would confront me with my behavior, and I would say to them, don't forget who's got the microphone this weekend. I was very sick. And I shredded the lives of a lot of good people in those days. Because in a small rural community, you don't have to mention names. All you have to do is nod or hint or smile or wink. And the only way of making amends to some of those people today is to show up sober and try and be a decent human being by God's grace. Early November 1985 came around, my friends, and I pretty well burned all my bridges. Nobody wanted me. I didn't even want me. I remember calling my boss. Told him I was leaving. I didn't know where I was going, what I was going to do. And all I heard him say was, do what you want to do. He was tired too. But he said, before you go, I want you to make a phone call. Strange how God works, my friends. 2 years before, 1983, when I was still dry and absolutely miserable, I was at a gathering something like this, and the Saturday night speaker touched me. I don't know to this day what he said, but he touched me, and I remember going up to him after the meeting. And I said to him, Hillary, one of these days I'd like to come visit you in Cullman, Alabama. I didn't even know where Cullman was. He reached in his pocket, he took out his card, he put it in my hand. And he said, when you are ready, come. And that's all he would say. 2 years later, somewhere in between, I must have mentioned it to my boss. He said, before you leave, I want you to make a phone call and call Hillary D. Father Hillary. And I did, and thank God he answered the phone, and I said, Hillary, this is Maliki. And across the silence of 2 years, I heard him say, are you ready? I said, of course I'm ready. He said, good, come. And he hung up. No directions. And then hopefully for me, my friends, the final saga began by God's grace. I like to sometimes think I left that church community. I didn't. I slunk away. Brought my dog with me. Planned to drive to Cullman, which is 454 miles due northeast of where I was living, by way of New Orleans. Somewhere along the way I had a drink, went into a blackout, and dropped my dog off with friends and told them I'd be back. Parked my car at the airport in New Orleans, flew to New York, flew to Ireland. Stayed with my mom for 5 days, that since she has reminded me about from time to time. Crossed over to France on the ferry and took the overnight express, the Trans-Euro-Nare, and I came out of that blackout 2 weeks later in a hotel room in Venice, Italy. That's a slight detour. And all those with me, my friends, in that hotel room were the four hideous horsemen. Saying, Maliki, do you want to ride again? I didn't know where I was, how I got there. I still have the MasterCard slips to remind me. Made my way back across Europe, and coming out of the blackout somewhere in the English Channel, I remember sitting on the rail of that liner on the back. Regular winter clothing, t-shirt and a pair of shorts. Getting ready to slide off that rail because I could see the foam beneath, and the only thought that came to me was, Maliki, if you jump, it'll all be over. It'll be all over. And just as I was getting ready to slide off that rail, I said 4 words that I'd so often said before. God, please help me. I had nowhere else to go. And strange in that long saga, 5 years, my friends, it seems that brought everything I had to experience to that point, because when I was first intervened on back in 1979,
And I was sharing this at breakfast. You know, why my bishop called me in was because the previous Sunday I was drunk and didn't show up to celebrate the Sunday evening mass, and the deacon came get me, and I got obnoxious, went over to the church in a t-shirt and a pair of pants, and I'd been sick on myself, drunk out of my mind, got on the microphone in the pulpit and told those people very simply, about 400 of them, you're nothing but a bunch of hypocrites, you don't need what I have, and walked out again. Now, I don't know about you, those of you who choose to go to a church, but that's not kind of the experience you kind of anticipate on a regular basis. But all it brought me to the point of that line or rail and putting myself in God's hands and then promptly taking myself back again. I don't remember too much more. I remember being in New York Thanksgiving Day of 1985, being loved by friends who today are still my friends out there in Long Island. Oh, goodness. Make a long story short, I ended up in Cullman, Alabama. It was December 3rd, 1985. It's been a day at a time since, by God's grace. When I got there, thank you, I like to believe that that applause is for the God of my understanding who works in all of us. Thank you. I met Hillary the following morning and he looked at me and he said, I'm not going to work with you. He can be so delicate at times, for those of you who know him. He said, I'm going to give you this other monk to work with. He's 14 years sober then. He had Parkinson's. I'll use his last name. He's since gone home to God. Malachi. That's how God works. Gives me another Malachi in my life. And he was also from the old country, from County Roscommon. Came over at a young age. Hillary said, I'll put a roof over the table, over your head. I'll put food on the table and you'll go to meetings. And I did. Sometimes three times a day. And Malachi, with his Parkinson's, he couldn't always come to meetings, so I became his meeting when I would come back. That's how he wanted it. Tell me everything you said and everything you heard. Preferably more of what you heard than what you said. Yeah. Sometimes three times a day, the downtown Cullman group, and I go to Arab and Boaz and Huntsville and Decatur and Area Assembly in Montgomery, Alabama, and just all over. Scared to death sometimes. I didn't take to it like a duck to water, but I knew if I didn't join you again, I'd be dead. And somehow you kept loving me and holding me by the hand. And you tell me, keep coming back, Malachi, it'll get better. And after 3 months of that, I tell you what, I did not want to hear that again. God, I used to want to throw up. Because with me, I wanted everything measured, you see. I mean, tell me, when's it going to get better? When's it going to get better? Malachi Shanahan would look me in the eye and he'd say, Malachi, I've got two questions for you. The first question is, did you get in trouble today? I'd say, no. He said, did you have a drink today? I'd say, no. Well, then he said, for an alcoholic, you're having a great day. And that's how he'd get me over those humps in the early days. And literally walked me through these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and forced me to listen to Chuck C's tapes and to read a new pair of glasses, and to read the text of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to read the text of the 12 and 12, and to report back to him and discuss it. He literally became my mentor. And there are many I met that loved me through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and helped me in my arrogance. I noticed that Hillary is coming to the Kansas State Young People's Conference in Alcoholics Anonymous. So glad to see that. And also Joe H., that I had the privilege to meet, who's one of the students of the text. Strange how God works. Hillary would tell his own story, and I learned from it. His first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, he wondered with his background, because he was rector of a college and a seminary, and he calls himself a divine of at least the second water, and aristocratically bred and mobile, and all those kind of other good things. He wanted to know how come someone like him, you know, was an alcoholic. And I kind of had the same question for me. As this old farmer Fred from Oneonta on the side of the mountain at a meeting one night, Hillary said, how come I'm an alcoholic? And Fred looked at him and he said, oh hell, Hillary, you don't ask how the jackass got in the ditch, you just get him out. So sometimes when my mind is on my mind, it's good for me to remember what was brought to Hillary by a farmer with a fourth grade education. who by God's grace is 38 years sober a day at a time. And he keeps it very simple. Keeps it very simple. I lived up there for 6 months, my friends. And I came back to Houma, Louisiana, and I was scared to death. I thought there was going to be no AA like Alabama AA. And it was fear. And I walked into this meeting, and I didn't know what to say. I kind of hid in the corner. And I remember them saying, "Does anyone have a problem?" And I said, "Oh, maybe I do." I said, "I need a sponsor." And I thought all of them were going to jump up and volunteer, and none of them did. Little different to Tom's approach. You know, they didn't kind of ask me for my phone number. But they knew of me. And they probably said, "This guy, you know, he's going to tread his own path for a while." That night on the way home, I remember Joe R. crossing my mind, that I'd met many moons ago and used to help grow in love and tolerance in those early days before I got drunk again. I called Joe that evening. He hadn't heard from me in a few years. Joe picked up the phone. I said, "Joe, this is Malachi." And all he said was, "Welcome home, Malachi. I've been waiting for your call." He told me to come to a meeting the following night at the Bayou Cajun group. I did. I went up to him and I said, "Joe," I said, "I'd like to be like you." He looked at me and he said, "Well, then do what I do." And I've been trying. The word is trying, my friends. God has a sense of humor. Even in those days when I've got a battle and I get his role confused, there are days where I believe God is the manager, the director, and other days I like to believe he's the consultant. And that can create interesting moments in my journey of recovery. I was restless, irritable, and discontent for a long time, my friends. Joe calls it having a bad dose of the RIDS. Restless, irritable, and discontent. And Joe R., my sponsor, says, "Malachi, every time you have a bad dose of the RIDS, there's only one question you need to ask yourself when you're restless, irritable, and discontent." I said, "What's the question, Joe?" He said, "Who is not doing it your way? Who is not doing it your way? Lots of people don't do it my way for some strange reason." Even in Applebee's yesterday evening. Huh? That's a story for another day. But I want to reassure you that alcoholism was alive and well for a while. I was very restless even in ministry. I got an invitation in 1988. I was, a little over 2 years growing sober at this stage, seriously. And got this gilt-edged invitation from the Air Force to join them and become a chaplain. I only saw two words in that entire letter: global ministry. And I like to have a spiritual orgasm on the spot, my friends, when I saw those two words. The call to carry the message to everybody. I sat down that Wednesday afternoon, I well remember, a beautiful sunshiny day, and I read that letter and reread that letter and, of course, formed the committee and chaired the committee, set the agenda, came to the conclusion, God was calling me. And then I called my sponsor. And he said, "You going to the meeting tonight?" I said, "I am." He said, "Good, we'll talk." And I spent that meeting refining my argument. I know no one else ever does this, in anticipation of a discussion with our sponsor about some life-threatening event. But I sat down for that meeting and I was refining how I would persuade my sponsor as to the wisdom of God's call to me. And we sat and had coffee after the meeting, and after I'd rambled on for 10 minutes and thought that I was very persuasive, he looked at me and he said, "Tear that letter up." I said, "Why would I want to tear the letter up?" He said, "Follow directions. Tear the letter up." And then I got a trifle perturbed. And I looked at him and I said, "Well, if I'm not supposed to join the Air Force, then what am I supposed to do?" He said, "Malachi, all I believe God wants you to do is to walk the sidewalk sober today. And I said, well, if you're that intelligent, how am I supposed to do that? Walk the sidewalk sober today. He said, it's very simple. You put one foot in front of the other. And that's all he would say. And I'm grateful to my God that I chose to follow directions, because I know if I had joined the Air Force, I would either be drunk or dead today. I am an alcoholic, and I have the disease of selfishness and self-centeredness. And I am self-will run riot if I do not do what I do, which is each morning get on my knees, which my sponsor made me do. It's strange, you know, for someone like me that was schooled in theology and scripture and all the other stuff for 8 years, I knew a lot about my God. But when I came to you, I met my God. And each morning I get on my knees and I say very simply, thank you, God, for today. Please keep me away from a drink or a drug just for today. And I pray the third step prayer. And it is okay. And I've had to keep doing that, and I keep doing it, my friends, because if I pause long enough and begin to think, I can create havoc and become that tornado again in a flash moment. Many other things have happened in sobriety, and I'll try and touch on them, my friends, so that we'll all get here before 2 o'clock. It's a journey. I don't know sometimes why my God loves me, but I know he does. I liked what Tom said about that last night. Even in our darkest moments and our better moments, my God does not change. But I know within myself there's a tremendous conflict, because I was trying to reconcile the God of my understanding that I was coming to have a relationship with in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the God of the system of which I was a part. And this is not about beating up on that system, because there's so much in each living experience that's important. I know it says to me, each person's religious views, if any, are their own affair. But I used to struggle with some stuff, and maybe I was too radical and too much of a rebel and whatever. I believe and have believed for a long time that everyone is welcome at the table. I do not believe my God makes distinctions. For those I walked with for many years, and those who found themselves divorced and remarried outside the church, I never was quite too sure what that meant, if it meant a field or somewhere outside the church. I used to believe everyone was welcome at the table, and that's how I used to speak in the churches where I pastored, and real people felt at peace and the system became perturbed. And from time to time I'd be challenged on that, and I'd say, well, that's my belief. And the time came though where I had to make a decision, and I talked to Joe about it regularly, and he'd say, Malachi, all I know is trust God, clean house, and help others. The answers will come if your own house is in order. Even at that time, I was a caregiver for RING, which is the Regional AIDS Interfaith Network. And I walked with people who were dying of AIDS, and they taught me so much about life and about dignity. And I also know how the system of which I was a part would shun them. One of my brother priests developed AIDS, and he went to his bishop, and the bishop said, you can't stay here. He looked at him and he said, I wonder what he said Jesus said to the lepers and the prostitutes. Time come where I had to fish or cut bait. And I made a decision that was extremely difficult for me, because I was moving on from something I loved after 22 years. I think I was really scared, though, if the truth were known, because if For so long I was self-supporting through other people's contributions. The thought of becoming self-supporting through my own was a little bit daunting. I think maybe I was afraid to grow up. And in the interim, my sponsor told me how God works. He said, Malachi, I want you to go back to school. I was sick of school. No, he said, I want you to go back to school. He said, I want you to apply to the School of Social Work at Tulane University. I want you to enter the graduate program. And I applied, and I was rejected. And I called him screaming. You embarrassed me! Yeah, not willing to accept responsibility for myself. He said, Malachi, bring me the letter. There were three paragraphs in it, you see. The only thing I saw was the rejection, you see. And you know how we alcoholics love rejection. Brought him the letter, he read it. He said, did you read this letter? I said, of course I did. What does it say? He said, well, the first paragraph said something about your application being late. When was the deadline? I said, June 1st. When did you mail it? June 6th. He said, why do you still want to be different? I said, the second paragraph said is we'd be happy to reconsider your application, and the third one was encouraging you to do it. So I did, and I was accepted. And I continued pastoring and going back to school, and I think God was giving me time to breathe with my home group. And to walk a day at a time and to ask him just basically for the discernment. And what came to me, my friends, is what it says on page 25. The central fact of our lives is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way that's indeed miraculous. I used to hang on to that many times during the day. I didn't feel it sometimes, but I hung on to it. Because even in the maddening days, so often when I wanted to end my life in the past, the only thought came to me was, the Lord is my light and my salvation, whom should I fear? The Lord is my life's refuge, of whom should I be afraid? And all I knew is that somehow, some way, my God would not let go of me in those maddening early days. And then even in those days of self-doubt of going back to school and what's going to happen and how am I going to face my mother and my family? Irish Catholic mothers are interesting. And of course at Ms. Ricky Paul, which is the Mid-South Young People's Conference in Alcoholics Anonymous, a couple of years before that I met a lady by the name of Lane. And she was a gift to me because she was the first woman I ever met that I didn't want to get into her pants. Strange. That we could become friends. You know. And I talked to Joe about that after I made the decision to move on. And I was scared to death. Well, he said, Malachi, if you get out of the way, it'll give God an opportunity to direct the traffic. He said, get on your knees, give it to God, and we'll see what happens. And Christmas of 1992, was it? Yeah. In the mail came to me a little troll doll with orange hair, dressed in a priest's cassock and a little cross. And it was from Lane. I wrote back to her and thanked her, and I told her that I told her of my decision to move on because I hadn't seen her in months, but we'd correspond from time to time. And I was still good at keeping my secrets. I was so afraid to tell another human being what was going on with me, especially a female. I went off to visit Tupelo, Mississippi that New Year's Day of 93. And I was scared to death because I felt something and it was out of my control and I didn't know what the hell to do. I didn't. But that evening I drove across to Cullman, Alabama, which is about 2 hours away. My friend Malachi Shanahan had died 3 years before. He wrote to me 2 hours before he died, as they estimated he died of a heart attack. And I remember the closing in the letter saying, Malachi, I am feeling very cold and I wish you were here with me. And all they found in his drawer was his 13-year chip of all of his chips, and they gave it to me, which I still have in my pocket. God works in strange ways. After I met with Lane and felt scared to death, I drove across to Cullman and I sat at Malachy Shanahan's grave for an hour. And I talked to him just like I'm talking to you. And I walked back down that avenue in that cemetery and I felt at peace. It was okay. And Lane and I, the relationship deepened, and it just somehow seemed the thing to do to get married. I remember the beginning of May of 1993 calling my sister in Ireland, telling her of my plans, and she said to me, "You've done enough havoc in this family. We will now take care of our mother. We don't want you in our life anymore." The middle of May, I was at the mountaintop roundup in Lake Gunnersville, North Alabama. Hillary was the voice. His approval was very important to me. He didn't say anything to me all weekend, although he interviewed Lane, if you know what I mean. And of course, our sponsor had interviewed me, because she's an active serving member of the Al-Anon family group for the past 14 years. And you will not hear me joking about Al-Anon from these podiums. She has people like Bo T and others brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous in the early days in North Alabama. Every Wednesday evening I'd meet with Bo and Shirley and with Cindy and with Mike when he was still living. Some evenings that he would come join us. And Bo loved me. And that's all I know about the Al-Anon family group. They hold up a mirror to me. See, two alcoholics get together, my friends, and we can just overwhelm ourselves with the fragrance of our own BS. You sit and talk with a focused member of the Al-Anon family group, and it's different. And I'm grateful. That Sunday morning when I finished speaking, Hillary came up to me, put his arm around me, and he said, "Malachy, I'm happy for you and Lane," and that was my sign. We went up to New York, August of 93, and we married out there in Long Island, the second oldest church, the Caroline Church, the oldest Episcopal churches in Williamsburg. Strangely enough, the canon who married us was drunk as a skunk. Delicious irony. You know, God's taking care of me. Lane says, "My God, look at him." I said, "All I need is his damn signature." Yeah. And then we came back, and I continued on in New Orleans because I was finishing off school, and Lane lived in Tupelo for the next 4 months. She has two sons, one who's almost 20 years old and one who's almost 16. The almost 20-year-old is embarking on a journey that more than likely will give us the opportunity to welcome him at some stage. September 23rd of 1994, God gave Lane and myself a little baby daughter. And I was scared to death before. I used to joke about it. I had a Baptist preacher say to me, "Malachy, they call you father. Are you a real father?" You know, back in those days, I said, "No." I said, "I don't know." But I said, "I was often in a blackout. And you know, we function perfectly." He didn't quite know what to make of that sometimes. Strange. September 23rd, 1994, I was there 1 minute to four. Our daughter was born. Her name is Bridget. Ashling, Bridget named after her maternal grandmother and her paternal great-grandmother. And Ashling, her middle name, is the Gaelic for beautiful dream, which she is. The greatest gift I can give my daughter today is that she has a sober dad. by God's grace. That's all I know. How has my life changed? Some massive changes in a few years. Lane is a gift in my life. Bridget's a gift in my life. I never thought I could have loved. When I held my little baby daughter and walked her down from that room to the nursery, there is no feeling like that feeling. And I know at times now, she was 17 months old on the 23rd, I can become regularly ballistic or bonkers in any given moment because I've got some ideas of things I would like to do and she's got some very definite ideas of what she wants to do. And so maybe she's helping me grow up. Yeah. But those moments when I come home in the evening and I do work at one of those psychiatric hospitals, by the way, as a clinical social worker. And the only reason I mention that is God sees fit to have me responsible for the CD unit. And so I work with hours, and when they sit with me, I look them in the eye, and I tell them very simply, I've done the dance, I know the dance, so let's move beyond the dance. And when I sit with the family in the very first get-together, and they're going on and on about him, I look at them very simply when they say, what do we need to do? What can we do? I said, you need to go to Al-Anon. I believe God has me where he needs me to be today. On the home front in Ireland, it was very painful for all my friends. I'll try and wrap up. My mother went into a deep depression. She would not acknowledge my wife's existence. She would not acknowledge the existence of her grandchild. She felt I turned my back on her God. She also felt that she had failed, which is often the curse of a mother, their perception. All I knew to do was to write to her and send her pictures. That's what my sponsor told me to do. And not try to point out to her where her beliefs and mine were different, but just to write to her in today, tell her what I was doing today, as I always did before, tell her about the rose garden, because I've always had a rose garden. You know, tell her about the fish in the pond, tell her about Bridget, tell her about the clothes, tell her about anything, just talk to her. And the gift that God has given me through Lane, my wife, is Lane being the mother of two sons, she would write to my mother, and she would write as a mother to another mother of sons. My mother would not write back to my wife. She'd write to me at the hospital, Reverend Malachy McCool. Bless her dear heart. She'd send me cards from Knock Shrine and from Lourdes in France. That's my mother's belief. My sponsor would say, Malachy, all you need to do is each morning get up and get on your knees and give the day to God. And in the days you want God to be your consultant, well, that's your business. In the days when you allow him to become the manager, it'll be different. And I kept doing what he asked me to do, and New Year's Day this year, because I call my mother once every few months on the phone, and talk, and I'd say, Mom, Bridget is here, she'd like to say something to you. She'd say, that's okay. Would you like to talk to Lane? No. I never thought of taking a drink, just like Tom last night. It's not the issue. God to me removes the obsession. He's either everything or he's nothing. But did I want to get even? Yes, I wanted to get even. Oh, yes, I wanted to get even. I have a way with words. I can find your weak spot, go for it, and shred you. But no, I would just write. New Year's Day, Lane would get on my case. She said, you know, you're going to call your mama for New Year's? I'd say, Lane, I said, you're losing your Al-Anon grip. No, she said, here we're talking family. She's your mother. She's 77. She's frail. Her days are winding down. She's your mother. I called her New Year's Day. My sister, who did not speak to me since May of 1992, answered the phone. And all I said was, how you doing, La Serena? She said, good, how's Bridget? And we talked. My younger brother and sister-in-law that I have not seen in 4.5 years are coming over next week to visit. And to someone else, that mightn't mean anything, but to me, these are miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous. They are those miracles, my friends. And I don't deserve any of them, but I'm so grateful that I have the opportunity to experience some of them. And would not have been possible without God's grace, as He gives it to me and you. Will I get to see my mom? I don't know. I'd love to be able to go over there with Lane and with Bridget so that she could see us. But that's not in the financial cards at the moment, and that's absolutely okay because that's the way it is. And if God wants, God will want, and whatever else is fine. Lane has taught me that either it is okay or it's not okay. Not it will be okay. It is or it isn't. And it is okay. Because my God is taking care of us today. I thought, my friends, I would never find myself saying to you today what I am able to say. And that very simply is, thank you so much for loving me. I love you.